Okay, so it's time to start the next session. This session is Beyond SDGs, Science for Wellbeing. So this is organized by collaboration by Japan Science and Technology, GST, and International Science Council, ISC. I will moderate the first half, and later, Dr. Lucia Spini will, in ISC, will moderate this session. So first of all, let me explain why we discuss about Beyond SDGs just over here. So as you know, SDGs are goal in 2030. That is almost 10 years. And do you think 10 years are long enough or short? When we remember that 10 years ago, the President Obama received a Nobel Prize for Peace, and Michael Jackson died, and we had a new type of flu, and WHO declared a pandemic. So maybe all of you remember clearly. So 10 years are not so long. So scientists and related people should think more than 10 years after SDGs. This is one logic. And another logic is, in order to achieve SDGs, we have to think more after SDGs. That is very important. So these are the why we discuss Beyond SDGs over here. And today we are planning to have a four presenters, but unfortunately, Minister Niemand in South Africa canceled the presentation over here. So we have three presenters and one commentator. So I'd like to start each presenter's presentations. And today, we'd like to have enough time for discussion, so I don't introduce the detail of each presenter's career bias. So first presenter is Dr. Nathalie Whampoa. She is an executive director of International Union of Biological Sciences in France. So could you start your presentation, please?
First of all, I would like to thank the organizer of the session for inviting me, and it's really a privilege to be in this place and to give a talk today. So I would like to start with the title of this session, which is Beyond SDGs, Science for Wellbeing. And I will mainly focus on, I'm representing here biologists, and on the interlinkage between well-being and nature. I will speak a little bit between nature and well-being in relation with urban areas and rural areas, and also between biodiversity, climate change, and well-being, the relationship between them, and then the importance of science and policy dialogue and education. As I said, I'm a biologist by training. I did my PhD in France at the Jacques Monod Institute and my postdoc in Stockholm in the Karolinska Institute. And I'm now the executive director of the International Union of Biological Sciences. So as you can see, we are a very old organization because we have celebrated this year our centenary. And the, I mean, our main goal is unifying biology through diversity. I think most of you don't know our organization, so briefly, we are, so the International Union of Biological Sciences, we are a group of 11 national organizations and national scientific members. And it's represented by national academies and international scientific associations and societies. and we represent a wide range of disciplines dealing with biology of microorganisms, plants, animals, ranging from cell biology, genetics, taxonomy, to ecology. So to come back to the talk, we know that half of the world population lives in urban areas, and in Europe, 70% of population lives in city. And urbanization profoundly alters the composition, abundance, and distribution of non-human species. And there are numbers of health issues that are related to biology. For instance, in hospital, there is the resistance to some organism that can cause serious illness or even death. In houses, you can have humidity and then proliferation of fungus that could be really harmful for health. From a biological point of view, allergic or urticant weeds, and with an increase of allergies, for instance, in cities, and for human beings living in cities, with the combination of pollution and these allergic plants. We know that to cope with heat waves, for instance, in European cities, it's advised to have parks and green areas. It's good also for mental health and physical health, also for humans. But then when we build these parks, we introduce non-native species that are often result in a complete restructuring of biotic communities. And on the other hand, you have also these domesticated and not domesticated animals that are host or vectors of human pathogen and diseases. So biology from the point of view of animals, plants, and microorganisms should be integrated in the overall approach of human being in urban areas. And I would like to show you some example of what a union like IUBS does to address these questions. We had a common project with the International Society of Zoological Sciences, and it's called Biological Consequences of Global Change. And this program focuses on outbreaks of diseases, invasion of alien species, and change in biological population. If you want to have more information, you can either take some brochures or go also to the website that is mentioned here. Now, in urban and rural areas, I would like to have a special focus on pastoralism, which is a livelihood that we don't have much information about it, because it's the estimate is between 50 and 500 million people living of this practice worldwide, and we don't know what are the viability of pastoral livelihood. So we have initiated in 2017 a project on the well-being of pastoral societies under climate change. And now it's a new project with the objective of developing standard to estimate the pastoralism under globality, to develop a set of sustainable indicators for pastoralism context. And the goals of the global analysis to the potential adaptability of the livelihood of in the face of climate change, and also the cost of benefit of this practice for biodiversity conservation. We are focusing on three different regions: Lapland, East Africa, and Mongolia. And then we are going to compare these different regions. So it's just started now, the implementation of this program in last July. So when it comes to biodiversity, climate change, and well-being, what we can say that with the industrialization, nature was mainly considered as a resource for human well-being, meaning benefit of human well-being. And we thought about the management, the sustainable management of stock of natural resources useful for human life. And we know that biodiversity and ecosystem, they contribute significantly to climate change adaptation. But at the same time, climate change is a major growing driver for diversity loss. And with climate change and biodiversity crisis, we also start to understand the vulnerability of nature and the impact of human actions. So biodiversity provides numerous ecosystem services that are crucial to human well-being and crucial to also achieve the sustainable goals. And people depend on biodiversity on their everyday life in ways that are still not always totally apparent or appreciated. So the ecological crisis could be an opportunity to reconsider the relationship between humans and nature and raise the awareness of people about the value of biodiversity. And then we need to work on the dialogue between science and policy and also on education. And I will show you a few examples also of what we are doing as a union. So regarding the dialogue between science and policy, we organize regularly the science forum in conjunction with the COP on biodiversity to share knowledge, approaches, and solutions among scientists, policymakers, and the civil society. So I'll give you example of the last two science forums that were organized with IUBS and with different partners like the CBD, and you have the list here of all the partners. And in Mexico, the topic was mainstreaming biodiversity for well-being and the contributions from science. And we had a special focus on agriculture, fishery, and forestry and tourism. Last year, we organized also a science forum with the European Commission, the CBD, and EIE on the topic this time was toward living in harmony with nature by 2050 and the science policy dialogue. And we are currently working on the next one that will happen in Kunming in China in October next year. Regarding science and education, we have developed, thanks to ISC, a project. It's an inter-union project. IUBS is the leader, but we have the list of all the partners here that are, most of them, they are also ISC members, but we have also academies that are members of IUBS. And the aim is to use climate change examples to teach science. So this is what we would like to do, is to integrate the climate change related topic with core curriculum for high school and undergraduate levels. It's also the democratization of knowledge to enable all humanity to invest their talents, skill, and ambition in a focused manner to address the problem of climate change. To produce reliable sources of curated and validated education resources that integrates topics of climate change with core curriculum for formal education system, and that to all students, irrespective of their discipline, area, or studies, would become aware of the causes and impact of climate change, and to equip them with skills to give innovative solutions regarding these problems. So we have two websites that you can consult, and we build we gather teaching tools to explain, through climate change using the teaching of science, and we also build lesson plan with guidelines for the teachers. So the first phase of the program was to gather all these tools in websites, and also we run different pilot workshop in different parts of the world. So we all together we went to 12 different places of the world, and we had trained, like, it's not really trained because we asked for feedback of the teachers, like 650 teachers so far. And now we're going to phase two, so we would like to disseminate this tool, also translate it in different languages. So then it could be, it could raise awareness everywhere in the world, regardless also of the language. And I would like also to speak about another project we have, but it's with younger kids. So it's sophisticated but inexpensive experimental modules in biology for rural school in developing countries. Because to teach lab experience could be sometimes expensive. So in this case, we know that one of the greatest assets of a rural area is that they have a life like plants and animals in the neighborhood. And these plants or animals could be used to teach the kids fundamental basic principles in science and methods, like what is how to conduct an experiment, what is a control experiment, and all these kinds of things. And we hope that apart from the benefit of the education, we could also have all the positive feedback, like the kids could get a great appreciation of the living world around them, and also realize the beauty and the fragility of the biodiversity around them. And by being directly in contact with this nature around them, plants and animals, understand them better, then we hope that they could also become interested in biodiversity, and they are going to be the one who in the future will have to protect the nature and also come with new ideas about the problems. So finally, I would like to conclude with the relation between well-being and nature, because science is crucial for human well-being in order to help us to understand global issues and to provide local solutions. But humans are not the only species in the biosphere, and our survival is dependent on how well the rest of the ecosystem is well preserved and everything is in balance. So until now, our objectives are mainly human-centric. Science can help us to respect nature regardless of the benefit for our own species, and also lead to an ethical reflection on life form, on their well-being. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Nazrin. You talked about the linkage between the people's well-being and the nature. Thank you. So next speaker is Kinde Tsering. She's director of Department of Agriculture, Minister of Agriculture and Forest in Bhutan. As you know, Bhutan is pursuing the happiness of the people, so we are looking forward to your talk. Please start it.
A very good evening. In fact, I feel really humbled to be standing here in front of all the distinguished participants and give a small presentation on Bhutan's agriculture policy for gross national happiness and well-being. First of all, before I move on with my presentation, I would like to acknowledge the support provided by the Japan Science and Technology Agency and Hungarian Academy of Science for giving me this opportunity to share some of my thoughts with the distinguished delegates that are here. The presentation outline that I have put up there, I will be discussing, giving a short background, talk on current status, some of the challenges and issues, some of the opportunities that lies there, moving ahead, what we are doing, agency interventions that are being put in place for well-being and for happiness. And then for the presentation, I'll have some closing remarks from my side to be presented to the participants here. But before I just came here, I quickly put two slides to introduce Bhutan. And this is because I have experience with some of my introduction that I made yesterday, that some people ask where Bhutan is. And this is definitely not to undermine the general knowledge of the participants here, but just to set the context about Bhutan and some of the key information that I will have to refer in my presentation. Bhutan is a small, tiny country up there in the Himalayas. And as you can see, the area we have is only 38,000 square kilometers. And in fact, the size is so small that we cannot even fit the six-letter word Bhutan on the map. So we had to borrow a space on the map from China to write down the word Bhutan. So you can make out how big or how small we are. The population we have is around 700,000 plus population. And the capital is called Thimphu. And I also would like to say that Bhutan is known to the world to some extent on some key topics such as gross national happiness. We are also known to the world for utilizing renewable energy, mainly 99% hydropower energy. We are known to the world for preserving our culture and tradition, and we are also known to the world for moving towards organic agriculture. So that is the brief background I would like to give. To move on, because this information I'll be relating time and again, Bhutan's conservation policy is very good. And in fact, we are very proud to say that our conservation targets that we have set is, you know, we have fulfilled. In fact, more than that, we have fulfilled. Our constitution mandates that we maintain 60% of the land area under forest cover, but right now we have 71%, and if we add 10% under scrubland, that makes the area under forest up to 81%. Out of this, out of the total area, we have 51% under national parks, biological corridors, and protected areas. And with this, the wild animal and the biodiversity in Bhutan is thriving. And in fact, I would like to mention that some of the Bengal tigers, wildcats, they do visit the capital city time and again. And that shows the wild animal which thrives down there in the southern plain also do travel up there in the snow-clad mountains. So that is how the biodiversity and nature is thriving in Bhutan. But the challenge we have, especially from agriculture perspective, is with regard to the net area under cultivation. We have less than 3% of the total area under cultivation or cultivable for food security and for nutrition security. So that sets the context of where we stand. Now to move on, I would like to talk about the Gross National Happiness Commission. And in fact, many people would have spoken about Gross National Happiness Gross National Happiness. To me, I mean, this is my personal context, and to me, the Bhutan's long-term development up until now, since it has been coined, have been guided by the concept of maximizing gross national happiness, No matter what we do, we have to converge towards increasing the happiness of the Bhutanese people. And all the development that we take place are envisaged through policies and programs that operationalize 4 pillars and 9 domains of Gross National Happiness Commission. Now, this sounds too technical, and maybe this sounds too theoretical as well, but we have indicators being framed so that we can measure time and again whether we are moving up on the scale or whether we are moving down on the scale. And all the development objectives for the nation are embodied in the national 5-year plans. And we usually break our development plans at five-year scale. For example, the current 12-5-year plan, which is from 2018 to 2023, the objective we have is just harmonious and sustainable society through centralized decentralization. And there are reasons why we are adopting this objective. The 5-year plans, which I have just mentioned, encompasses number of milestones that we have set for ourselves. For example, the Vision 2020, which we have developed, the economic development plan, as well as the milestone, which we have kept for ourselves to graduate from least developed countries. And all these milestones and objectives, we have to acknowledge that these are all drawn from the timeless vision and wisdom of our monarchs. And of course, taking into consideration of the sustainable development goals and other regional and international commitments. For example, I would like to mention that Bhutan have committed to remain carbon neutral target, to remain carbon neutral forever. We have this land degradation neutrality target. We have this biodiversity targets, which are very ambitious, but we are seriously pursuing these targets. So all these are being used to frame the development objectives that we have in Bhutan. To zoom into the sector that that I work for, the 12-5-year plan formulation execution and implementation, these are all pinned by the principles of coordination, consolidation, and collaboration. And these three words are not really new to anybody. In fact, all the earlier speakers that I've attended yesterday did talk time and again about these three C's that need to work together to be able to achieve the sustainable development goals. In fact, I would like to mention here that the 12th five-year plan will be Bhutan's last five-year plan as a least developed country, and we will be graduating in 2023. So for the Ministry of Agriculture and Forest, we have two primary mandates to be fulfilled. One is to enhance food and nutrition security, and the other one is to conserve and manage natural forest resources and biodiversity. And as I mentioned earlier, for the forest resource and biodiversity, we are doing a great job. But when it comes to food and nutrition security, we are still lagging behind, which demands our attention and resources. There are a few acts and policies that guide the Ministry of Agriculture and Forest, such as Food and Nutrition Security Policy of the Kingdom of Bhutan, such as Forest and Nature Conservation Act, and many more, such as Biodiversity Strategic Action Plan, Organic Master Plan that we have. And all these policies and plans have to be screened through Gross National Happiness Policy Screening Tool. All the projects that we implement have to be screened through Gross National Happiness Project Screening Tool, which consists of so many indicators and variables. Now, the current status, I would like to touch a little bit on this. With the implementation of the plan 5 year, the past plan period, we have experienced rapid economic growth, and we have managed to reduce poverty. But we also noticed that these are mainly driven by the hydropower that is there in Bhutan. And in fact, agriculture comes the third, fourth sector which contributes to this. The agriculture, which is so close to my heart, is predominantly subsistence. But the good thing is, it provides livelihood to 57% of the population. So that makes it so important for the economy of Bhutan. And through this, through the past intervention, we did improve the food security, we did improve the nutrition, but nevertheless, food insecurity still exists in rural areas, food self-sufficiency is still not 100%, nutrition-related disorders are still prevalent, and we have negative trade imbalance. So these calls for the attention towards achieving the sustainable development goals. And because, as I mentioned earlier, these are more of rural phenomenon. We see more poverty in rural areas than the urban areas. We see happiness index lower in rural areas than in the urban areas. Therefore, the decentralization objective was pursued in the 12th five-year plan. And accordingly, the resources, the authority, the responsibility, and accountability have been devolved to the local governance, and resources have now no longer, it's a top-down approach, it is literally 50-50%, so that's how we are pursuing the implementation of the program in the 12th five-year plan and working towards the sustainable development goals. In addition to this, we have also come up with a flagship program that is targeting key issues like youth unemployment, key issues like water insecurity, poverty. So these are the areas that we have been working. This is just to highlight some of the pictures. As I mentioned earlier, food insecurity, food sufficiency is still not there, which demands our attention. Now to move on, some of the key challenges and issues that I would like to touch on. We are doing great when it comes to climate action. We are doing great when this comes to action on land. We are doing great on many fronts. But along with that, the other side of it, we are having wildlife and human conflict experienced by the farming community time and again. We are having farm labor shortage on one hand. At the same time, with education being improved in Bhutan, we are having youth unemployment on the other side. So there are issues like rural-urban migration. There are issues like farm mechanization, which is leading to all this. Then the irrigation problem, it is applicable across the globe. We are bearing the brunt of climate change, and we are having problem when it comes to commercialization, when it comes to food security promotion. And the other one is agricultural land. Whether we like it or not, we are losing it to urbanization. We are losing it to natural disasters that comes along with the climate change. And then the productivity and production, these are also being challenged. the climate-induced disasters being felt in nooks and corners of Bhutan. And last, and a very important point is, the challenge we have is limited national capacity in terms of institutional capacity, infrastructure, human and technical capacity. Just to reiterate some of the points here that, this has been portrayed by many, so even for Bhutan, we are not being spared, the temperature is rising. Climate change impacts is felt, as I mentioned earlier, the glacier lake outburst, the reduction in water availability, the excessive rainfall during monsoon, when we have too much, when we don't have it at all. The windstorm, which we have never experienced in the past, drought, which was not experienced in the past. These are all challenges being faced by the Bhutanese farming community. Additionally, pest and disease outbreak. I just would like to highlight that the giant African land snails, never seen in Bhutan, have entered Bhutan and creating havoc. Right now it's been contained, but this is going to spread to other parts. Shift in vegetation, places which we could grow, now we no longer can grow. Where we could not grow, we are growing. So these are posing lots of challenges to the Bhutanese farming population. Having said so, I don't want to paint a very gray picture. We have lots of opportunities. We have domestic market potential to be capitalized with the population increase, with the urbanization, disposable income being increased. Huge export potential just across the border. We have this. We have the opportunity to increase production productivity. That is where science and technology and innovation is required. We have the opportunity to improve our national food self-sufficiency, change in diet habits. You know, there are many things which we could do. Organic farming and brand Bhutan, we have the opportunity, because for the normal cultivation, we can't compete with India and China. There is no fun in doing that. So we would like to capitalize on niche market, high value, low volume commodities. We have the opportunity. Private sector and youth to be engaged. These are some of the opportunities we have. Moving forward, I would like to mention that the geography of Bhutan presents a very interesting and intersecting challenges and opportunities. For example, small and landlocked with mountainous terrain do complicate production, transportation, and everything. But we are also well endowed with the natural resources and two large economies of the world towards north and south. And the challenge we have now is, how can we negotiate these challenges and at the same time harness the opportunities that are lying there for Bhutan to capitalize? And as I mentioned earlier, to track the progress, we use Gross National Happiness Index to measure, and we also use the findings so that we make appropriate plans and we implement it accordingly. And all the plans and programs are implemented through these 7 major programs in the current plan period, and these are all being consolidated because we don't have the luxury of resources, and we really need to consolidate, collaborate, and work together. To zoom down to the Department of Agriculture, which is the area where I work with, we have vision, mission, and development objectives all set. And in fact, for the information of the participants here, our vision, mission, objectives, national key result areas are all aligned with the 9 domains of gross national happiness. And all our national key result areas, which consist of 7, are realigned with the sustainable development goals. So we are not working in isolation. We are seriously pursuing. And the strategies we have, I have put up 18 strategies. This may seem too much to be handled by a small, tiny country like Bhutan, but what we are looking at is we have to consider the well-being, the feelings of the Bhutanese population. So that is where commercialization have the potential, we move on there. Where there is a potential for selected commodities, we move towards organic farming. Where there is opportunity for research, enterprise development, that is where we move towards. But the key to this is we are in the process of strengthening research and innovation, and we are definitely implementing smart agriculture technologies and green technologies very seriously. These are some of the pictures that I have just put up there. And the key message that I'm putting here is that we are seriously pursuing to promote innovative and enterprising agriculture to make Bhutanese farming productive, profitable, and prestigious. Otherwise, we see a very gloomy picture for agriculture sector in Bhutan because youths are not willing to do business as usual. because Bhutan is experiencing the wrath of climate change, so we really need to change along with the needs of the time. To close my presentation, I just would like to give a few words to be submitted here. Bhutan and similar countries like Bhutan, I don't think we can afford to be ignorant, and it is the need of the hour, because poverty is there. I mean, whether we can achieve by 2030 is still a question, to be asked. We really need to strengthen the HR and boost scientific knowledge at all levels. Wherever possible, within the available means, we also need to, the country needs to invest. We need to invent, we need to screen, we need to adopt, we need to work, test within the available means to overcome the challenges. We simply should not be relying on somebody to come and do things for us. So that is a message that is applicable for Bhutan and similar countries. Science, technology, and innovation is inevitable. I think there is no doubt about it, for maximizing gross national happiness commission. GNH cannot work in isolation. SDGs cannot work in isolation. We need science, innovation, and technology. In fact, these technologies are required, which are rigorous, relevant, and relevant to the local and national context, very important, ethical, and responsible. And we really need to come up with good scientific data to guide our politicians to take informed and wise decisions, not something which they feel like making commitments. So we really need to work towards that. SDGs should not be looked at in isolation. Other pertinent issues which individual country suffers or experiences that will have to be taken on board in the process of achieving the SDGs. The fourth point which I would like to mention is, for achieving SDGs, world should be viewed as one nation, and no nation should be left behind, which I think time and again we talk about it. We need to come up with interventions, what we mean by leaving no one behind. I think that calls for attention of all the scientists who are here, all the decision makers who are here. I also would like to mention that key challenges and key entry points needs to be identified and taken on board, because the challenges I face is going to be very different to the challenges Japanese will face. So we need to find entry points and implement it accordingly. Last but not the least, I'm just reflecting the words mentioned by some of the earlier speakers. Collaboration, commitment, and consolidation is imperative. It's important from the developed world point of view that they should feel responsible to take on board, to tag along the developing world. The developing world needs to commit that they also allocate resources and energy towards fulfilling SDGs. So this is the last word that I have, I would like to present to the members here. Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity. Gadinchi.
Thank you very much for your explanation of your situation and your challenge and strategy in Bhutan. Thank you, Kinle. So the final presenter is Koji Saeki. He is a senior vice president of the Japan Science and Technology Agency. He will talk about how to obtain the people's well-being, focusing on co-creation. Please start it.
Thank you so much for your kind introduction. And I'd like to join my predecessors to thanking the Hungarian Academy of Sciences and the organizer of this session for providing me with a chance to make some presentation here about our activities. I'm from JST, Japan Science and Technology Agency. JST is a funding agency in Japan, and also we have the human resources development program, like supporting science education, and also we have some think tank function to establish research and development strategies. Well, the title Beyond SDGs, it's a little bit difficult for me to explain. SDGs are quite a broad concept, and we are still away from achieving that. So in my speech, I'd like to share our experiences with you about SDG-related activities in JST. And then I'd like to explain policy direction of JST based on our experiences and expecting the future society after 2030. Here, we are facing various issues and challenges, and those are consolidated into SDGs, I think. And SDI, science, technology, and innovation, is necessary to solve these issues. We, in JST, have various activities concerning the science in and science for societies. We have strengthened our organizations. Like in 2018, we have set up Office of SDI for SDGs to promote related activities more smoothly. As to the funding, we have started the joint R&D program with developing countries in 2009, and then these COI, JST Mirai program, and so on, is funding programs to support R&Ds to realize better society, solving issues related to the district or the in Japan situation. And also, we have experience in the bottom line, the Great East Japan earthquakes, and JST has played a role in promoting recovery from the damages in the region devastated by the tsunami. Well, I talk a little bit about our program. The SADREPS is an international cooperative program, a science and technology research partnership for sustainable development was the name, and was established in order to promote joint international R&D program to solve issues in developing countries. And we put stress on the capacity building and capacity development in developing countries. Our program was implemented through collaboration with Ministry of Foreign Affairs and JICA, Japanese ODA agency, and the research activities in developing countries are supported by Japanese ODA. The second one, COI, is a Center of Innovation program. This is a project to support creation of innovation platform to realize a future vision. And within this program, researchers from universities and companies, or industries, work together under one roof at this Center of Innovation and try to realize the basic research's output to actual implementation in the future. Third one is JST Mirai program. Mirai is future in Japanese. And it was aimed to promote research for solution to realize future society, such as low carbon emissions society. Emphasis on R&D aiming at actual implementation. And the ideas for research themes were also called for in public. Here I'd like to explain a little bit about what experience in disaster recovery or revitalization. We, JST, use our funding capability and our system for review, and that means advisors of wide area, and matching capability, seeking problems and searching for the knowledge of scientists to assist solving the problems, and the prayer to implement actual business or the economic activities and so on. During that process, we learned that needs or problems are quite different according to each area. And science knowledge plus actual prayer for social implementation is necessary for this kind of revitalization. And to achieve that goal, also some kind of advisory function is really important. With support from the outsider's eyes, with wider vision, will make it more smooth for the basic research to the implementation phase. That means we have to invite a lot of stakeholders to participate in our activities. And also, we learned that quite a comprehensive way of designing future and implementing certain social activities is really important. For example, there is a region with advanced care system for elders, but this region experienced quite severe casualties by tsunami. Since elderly people in Japan wish to spend their time in their home, their own home, so the local government, with their good welfare system, realized that. But when tsunami came, the people need help. Those need help are spread all over the district, and it's very difficult for them to conduct evacuation rescue effort that end in a lot of casualties. So we need quite a comprehensive and the holistic approach for the future design. Now I'd like to come to the society after 2030s. The climate change results in extreme weathers. And in Japan, we have seen a lot of heavy rain or typhoon and so on. Once in a 100 years event, it is almost become annual phenomenon right now in near future. So new capability in forecasting or reporting or countermeasures are necessary, both for hardware and the systems or organization scheme for cooperation. I mean, for Japan in particular, we are experiencing aging and decreasing population in quite a speed. Japanese population peaked at 128 million in 2004, and we expected it as 150 million in 2030, 95 million in 2050. But the same situation will be experienced among many nations, especially in Asia, East Asia, and some countries in Europe and so on. So STI, Science and Technology Innovation, to support society with less population is necessary, and diversity is really necessary. We need a lot of people to participate in social activities, and STI to support challenged people, handicapped people, is also important, as Dr. Asakawa presented this morning. The other point is technology and players. I will not explain in detail, but artificial intelligence will change our society and will be a powerful tool to solve many difficulties. But at the same time, there are many questions about what type of society we would like to see during artificial intelligence time. And we convene the Science Agora, which is open forum to discuss science with the general public and among the general public and scientists and so on. And we have a session for the AI, and this kind of question was raised during that time. Also big data, and also machine learning, and private enterprise with huge assets. I will not explain about the detail or the actual names, but they have quite a financial power, technological power, and their activities and influences cross border and beyond borders. So they are really a huge player in that time, and gene editing and so on. So under these circumstances, there is a need for deliberations and shared images for future. So what shall we do to tackle this? As to the science in and science for society and like and SDG issues, we suppose engagement of diverse stakeholders necessary. And also the engagement of these stakeholders from the very early point of the project, like a project planning space, and share the common vision, view for the future society. So we call it like as a co-creation of science project program, science project, and so on, and co-creation, co-implementation. And the other part is initiatives in region is really important. Regional activities addressing complicated challenge in a holistic manner is really important, as I explained the example in the tsunami disaster. But in Japan, science policy has been rather national or government level issues. So using SDI for issues like SDGs, solving problems, a holistic approach in each region is really important. There are some activities of us about this, these challenges. One is a chance, open platform for co-designing the future. This is a kind of open platform of platforms, so that various stakeholders, various people can participate in designing phase of the future through a lot of discussions. Those are some of photos of these activities. And as to the initiative to supporting initiatives in the regions, we started several activities to support regional activities initiatives. For the part of funding, we established a new program, solution-driven co-creative R&D program, in which we support through open call the funding and funding to deliberation of the future planning phase. We support that. So we try to engage a lot of stakeholders into the regional level activities from very early stage. JASA is a SDI for SDGs prize, and we give spotlight to good practices and try to share the practice among other regions. Those are some of the projects, like high school students checking the history of the water level and processing the sea level rises. And that kind of activities draw attention from people in the region and also support the fostering of the next generation for the sciences. So here's another topic. We are starting Moonshot R&D program starting from this year, aiming at disruptive innovation, forcing future society R&D on themes difficult to accomplish, but could lead to huge impact. We are convening an international symposium on this program and discuss about our possible target themes, like expand human potential for our society or liberate human life through the research and function on the nervous system and related issues, tissues, and so on. So, in a summary, from our experiences, we think we need co-creation of science policy, strategy, projects aiming at science for well-being and science for all people and science for future. That is the end of my presentation. Thank you for your kind attention.
Great. Thank you very much. Amazing presentation. Can I have another round of applause for all the three presenters? So that you get some energy, because soon is your turn to contribute to the discussion. So my name is Lucilla Spini. I work at the International Science Council. And I'm also part of the organizing committee of the forum, so you can tell me later what didn't work and stuff. But when I saw the proposal from Dr. Watanabe about this session, I was like, finally, somebody has a little bit of longer-term vision. Because it reminds me of a personal time, a professional time in my life, actually. More than 10 years ago, I was working at FAO, at the Food and Agriculture Organization. You know, we were dealing with food security, nutritional security. And it was the time we were implementing the Millennium Development Goals. Clear target, everybody was on track. Every time we had to report on something, we had to indicate the MDGs and things. And I was, you know, a young professional, and I was, you know, very determined at achieving all that. One day I saw my boss really worried because they forgot something in the MDGs. It was a time where Africa was, most of African countries were under civil unrest because one of the solutions that we found was bioenergy for environmental issues. But what we forgot at the time is actually to link three things: climate change, bioenergy, and food security. And there were activities in all these three different things, but nobody was linking them to each other. And, oh, okay, well, you forgot, you are working in silos, we know the UN does that. But actually, that led to civil unrest. That led to major consequence in human population. It was a shock for me, because I've never seen, you know, high-level UN officials being too worried about, because I wasn't working any particular, you know, post-conflict or conflict resolution type of activities. So what I'm very happy today is that to hear the presentations, and I hear this holistic approach on how to address the further implementation of the SDGs, but also to look ahead. And in particular, I would like to recall three main things before I call our distinguished discussant to give some remarks. But I would like to say the holistic approach takes into account that, first of all, people are not the only species on this planet. We are part of nature. There are lots of different perspectives on this, of course. I'm a biological anthropologist. I've been studying chimpanzees. I'm a bit biased. We're just part of the overall primates, you know, order. But that we're part of a system. We're part of the planet. We are another species on this planet. We also should consider non-human beings also as some kind of stakeholders. And also, when we look at the SDGs, in order to avoid those problems which I highlighted for the MDGs, we should not look at SDGs in isolation. There are interlinkages. It's true that each country can prioritize and according to the local reality, the national reality, the regional realities, but you cannot say, I'm just going to do 1 and 2 and forgot 13 and 14. It doesn't work. Otherwise, you're going to have those crises that I experienced in 2008. And also, last but not the least, if you look at Agenda 2030, yes, it's been adopted by countries. Some of you actually were in that room at the time in September 2015. But it's actually an agenda for everybody, for all stakeholders, including scientists. And also, scientists have to work with many different stakeholders, and hence the importance of the co-production of knowledge, of policy, of initiative, and importance of working together. So this is very important to remember, because sometimes we think, oh, it's an intergovernmental agenda, it's the UN. At some point, they will fix it from up above. It's actually to each one of us to implement it through education program, through food security and nutritional programs, to scientific initiative and partnership, also involving students and young scientists. And I'm very happy to see many young scientists at the World Science Forum. It's quite an amazing thing. But also, we should start looking, again, in an holistic perspective on the Agenda 2030. We should go and reread it, not just to remember what we have to implement, but to see if we're missing some particular issues. If you take the PDF document of Agenda 2030 and you start looking for digital, you're going to be surprised. It's not mentioned many times. We're talking about artificial intelligence, ethical implication. It's actually not really taken into consideration. So let's work now that we still have some time to make sure that we have not forgotten something that in 2022, the year we're going to celebrate the International Year of Basic Science for Sustainable Development, we say, oops, we forgot that. So now I'm going to challenge my colleague from UNESCO, Dr. Nazar Hassan, a senior regional science and technology specialist for the Arab States at UNESCO, to tell us what's missing in that list of SDGs or on Agenda 2030. Thank you. No pressure on UNESCO.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. And thank you just for the opportunity to come and be part of this discussion. Well, first of all, I couldn't agree more with the panelists that human well-being and the capabilities to advance human well-being has to be at the core of the transformations to sustainable development. So here we're talking about material well-being, health, education, food security, abilities, access to clean and safe environment, resilience. That has to be all part of what we get after 2030. But it's also quite a challenge because if you talk about business as usual, it will not cut it. We will not be there. If you talk about education, the same way we're doing it today, bearing in mind the weak capabilities of developing countries, it's going to be tough. Resources, funding, you name it, we have a huge problem. And I don't think the international community have agreed yet on how to tackle these issues. For example, at a regional level, sustainable development targets related to poverty, education, food security, there are still great challenges to be tackled. So how is it that we picture or we can even think about putting a vision for what is beyond 2030? You know, I'm trying to be the devil's advocate here with my panelists. What can we say? Two things. If you talk about a global commitment for leaving no one behind, there are certain targets that people can work on. For example, we know that we have about 1 billion people around the planet with no access to electricity. We have about 4 billion that use polluting solid fuels for their energy demands. We know that about 1 billion people are at the extreme poverty level, which is less than $2 a day. We have another 1 billion that make a range between $2 and $3 a day. I think it would be a shame to come or arrive at 2030 for the global community and still see these pockets of populations around and not having their demands tackled. But again, on the other side, and I think I caught a phrase or two from the presentation that we're given, that we need, especially for developing countries, more of a self-reliance. you know, it has been in international forums discussions about who is going to invest, who's going to pay the hefty bill of actually achieving the 2030 goals. And usually you see that developing countries are waiting to receive the funding, their capabilities development and stuff like that. In the Buten's presentation, the word self-reliance came out big. And I really commend the government of Bhutan because they are actually tackling real practical issues. Can we do that around for the rest of the world? I think, yes, we can. But what is it that can really be done at a level where you have extreme poverty? As I said, if it's less than $2 a day, what type of commitment would the global community have towards those type of people? It's really difficult and it's really complex. Sustainable development is a complex problem. Okay, you talk about optimizing a multi-objective problem, which is still doable mathematically, but when you look at the resources and who is going to do what, the responsibilities are vaguely defined, and but for me, I still let me try, and it's just a trial here. You know, I'm just thinking out loud, and thank you for actually putting me in that hot spot. When you talk about governance in developing countries, what could really be done there? Okay. First of all, you have institutional frameworks and policies that needs to be put in place. For example, instead of having, let's say in a country, 30 or 35 different ministries, and that comes with a big government expenditure cost. Okay, why can't we have less ministries where synergy can be better, where actually working between line ministers becomes better? And of course, you have a lot of actually savings in government expenditure that can be put towards development. Now, another thing, when you talk about partnerships, do you do partnerships at a level of a federal government or at a state government level or at a local level? I think, and that is a mere opinion of mine, if you don't include the final beneficiaries at the local level, okay, to actually pump them up, to actually look after their well-being, then to ask someone from outside to come and do that for you is a little bit, what can I say? Not the right thing. Why? Because if you are not keen to develop yourself, to put yourself on track, why should somebody else do that for you? So when you talk about, for example, partnership, and maybe we had that discussion kind of before, private sector for the last decade or so, a lot of talk about private sector that needs to come and do development work in a country. But what we see is little move from the side of private sector to come and actually take the responsibility. Can we form a new level of partnership with the local communities? And I go back to what has been done about 20 or 30 years ago and use local cooperatives supported with private sector, and it doesn't have to be national private sector, even if you can have international private sector coming and helping out, because at the end of the day, private sector needs to have secure investments and return on investment. And if that condition is actually fulfilled, then things might go forward. These cooperatives can actually do a lot of work. They can have projects in infrastructure and industry. They can have work on education, on basic services, on food security, and of course, poverty eradication, because if these cooperatives actually have projects, then local employability rate increases. So you are actually doing things in a balanced manner. But who is going to take such an idea to that level and make it work well in a country or two? That is the difficult challenge. So basically what I'm trying to say is human well-being is everybody's responsibility. That is a private responsibility. And people need to be moved towards taking that responsibility, and for the global community to work and support that would be excellent. For example, we talk about education. If we get free internet service all over the world for developing countries, okay, then everybody's got a mobile. Everybody can learn a lot of the stuff that they need to learn and catch up very fast. Yes, it is informal education, but it should be quickest, because again, I'm going to repeat it, business as usual, what is happening today in our systems is not going to cut it. So governments, stakeholders need to come with creative, innovative, new social systems that can actually give the support. Am I done?
Yeah, 10 years ago.
10 years ago? So with that thought, I ask myself, are we going to be there by 2030? I think we can, but not the way we're doing it today. Thank you very much.
Time is always an issue, isn't it? So now we have some time for questions. I could see one over there. If somebody can help me. Okay, microphone.
Hello. Two. Okay, so this is practically the end of the forum. I was late. I'm sorry. I'm Julius.
Hi, Julius. Where are you from?
Earth.
Fantastic.
Nice to meet you all. I'm going to sit down. So this meeting over here was the best I've seen, and have only watched the last three presentations. I thank you from Bhutan. Love the country, have studied it for many years. On the last talk, yes, the system is available and we have started it. We are working with African countries, Mali, Sierra Leone, Burundi. We actually had the difficulties you were telling about internet and connectivity over there. It was hard to talk to the people inside. But we have built a functioning system between NGOs, organizational, governments, state, private stakeholders, and people, in which we educate people, and we fully educate society, and we are changing the way Earth is. It's called the Association Earth, New Utopia. I am ambassador of New Utopia. A bit nervous here, a lot of people, sorry. And on food security, you were saying, has anybody ever seen food forests as an answer for our food security? It's the only, after all the research we have done, it is the only way to geoengineer Earth into productivity. We geoengineer Earth into productivity by creating food forests. This is the only way we can do it on Earth. We have studied it, tested it, many have been done. We started one here in Szeged. We are starting a nice food forest in Szeged. It's a technology made by science, driven from permaculture. You can find it while you're available, it's everywhere. So wanted to ask you questions, but no questions. Just please work with us and work with the association in this Bhutan, especially. I love your, we love your mentality and nature and everything. I've been wanting to come, actually wanted to move to the country fully a couple of years ago until I decided that I'm supposed to work on Earth and do what I'm doing. So please just work with us. We are already, don't know, many collaborations in Africa, some in Eastern Europe, and a lot. You can find us, or we will find you.
Thank you so much for this intervention. You know, we have a dinner afterwards, and that's the time where you swap business cards and brochure. But also allow me to say that if you want to contribute to the SDGs processes, you can contribute through your country, but you also can contribute to the Scientific and Technological Community Major Group, which is the non-state actors in the UN for the scientific community. I'm coordinating the group together with colleagues at the World Federation of Engineering Organizations, and I'm happy to get your contacts and get you into the process as well. We have another question there, and then we'll do a final round of comments.
Thank you for the interesting presentation. I like to know, are there any collaboration or planned collaboration between Japan and Bhutan for performing the sustainable development goals?
Okay, keep that question in mind. Another question over there.
Yes, my question is the Bhutan and the Japanese colleagues, because I've been deeply involved in the SDI for SDG platforms organized by the United Nations. So that platform, it took the 4 years, but we had already developed the SDI for SDGs roadmap, particularly the including the funding system. How to redesign the funding system is very, very important to address the not only the global funding system, but also the local national funding systems to address the local values and the national value. So the Bhutan, you talk about the global fund for your last portion is the my question. And also the SAICS and the, I ask you the how to redesign your JST's funding systems. I mean the one part is the supporting the basic science. Another one is the mission oriented science and R&D is for address the Japan's SDG and bridging the Asian creating the SDG values. So the general question to you. Thank you.
Great, thanks. We have another question here, Ambassador.
Thank you very much. I'm Hungary's ambassador to the United Nations, so very much part of the whole process from the very beginning. You've been talking about the importance of communicating with the living beings, right? Not only with the human beings, but with the living beings, which is a kind of an overarching principle, I would say. In the SDGs, of course, we discuss whether we can reach at all by 2030. I'm not so positive about that, but we can talk about it during dinner, because obviously I'm monitoring the whole process. There are some serious problems. And here I would like to go back to SDG 5, which is an overarching principle, the role of women in SDGs. So I would like to refer these questions to the panelists. It's all about responsibility, ethics, and science this week in Budapest. But when we talk about your models, for example, in Bhutan, I know very well that the role of women is very influential. So I would like to ask you about that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask the panelists to respond to the question. And I'm going to ask each of you, actually, discuss and include. So let's start with Bhutan. Our colleague from Bhutan, would you like to answer some of the questions? Since there was a lot of interest. We all want to know the recipe for happiness, so that's...
thank you. I hope I got the questions correct, but let me try and give an attempt. The first question with regard to the collaboration between Bhutan and Japan. In fact, I would like to mention that Japan is one of the main development partners supporting Bhutan towards achieving the gross national happiness or sustainable development goals. So for that, yes, we have lots of technical cooperation. We have technical grant projects supported by Japan. And in fact, we have proposed two satraps, which was presented earlier, whereby we want to do science and technology and working on green infrastructure from climate change perspective. So these are the ones that we are talking about. The second question, which I hope I got it correct, but the response from my side is, yes, I proposed collaboration, consolidation, and commitment as a part of it, that a global fund, if it can be created, so that mainly targeting the developing world where they have the urge to work towards fulfilling SDGs, but they may not have the means to do it. So for that, a global fund, it could be pooled from development partners, it could be as a part of this big private company's CSR fund to be allocated, and of course, making the beneficiary countries also to pump some amount into it so that they can work towards achieving the sustainable development goals. The last question, the gender.
Yes.
I don't think I got your question correctly, but I would like to mention that even for Bhutan's national key result areas, we are working very seriously towards achieving towards a gender neutral society. And in fact, we are very much aware that in terms of education, the enrollment at primary and secondary is very good, 50-50. But as we move to the tertiary level, that is where we see a sharp decline. Similarly, in the scientific world, we notice that the women as a scientist is very limited. Women in executive position is also very limited. So government is putting their heart and soul. We are working very hard towards improving the representation of women in all the sectors. So thank you. I hope I answered your question.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask Natalie to give some example on how the International Union of Biological Science managed different international projects. And let me tell you, they don't have, if I may, great, huge resource or funds. But by getting together different associations, different groups, they leverage also in-kind and counterpart contribution and knowledge and funds as well a little bit, but I really would like to give a flavor on how the International Scientific Union works and managed to leverage funds and new activities and new ideas, and also latest development on gender equality from that side.
Yeah, the project on gender equality, so we have partners with different unions, so it's not only the biological unions, but we have the mathematical, physics, chemistry, astronomy, and it was also actually a project sponsored by ISC. And we got all together to understand why we have less women that choose some scientific fields, because as actually we mentioned, science is important for the well-being, and we need to include half of the population that is female also in the science. And we develop with all this union, we checked what was the different best practices we could share to attract women in scientific career. What are also the problems? Because, for instance, in biology, you can attract more females than in physics or mathematics, for instance. But at the end, in a top position, you don't have more female biologists than in the other fields. So this is a work in progress. Actually, what was good is that we could manage to build this important network with all the unions, with all the different disciplines. And that's really important because we can learn from each other. We can see what was implemented in some field that could work or not work, and see how we can also all together improve this education and attract more girls and for the future in scientific education.
Thank you. So I'm going to ask our colleague from Japan. Some comments on the question, but also, it's the 31st of December, 2030. You have to give a press conference. What is your first line?
congratulations. We have done a little bit. Anyway, it's very difficult to gauge how far we can go achieve the SDGs. It's a little bit difficult, and the concept or the image of the how far we go is depending on who we are asking that question. So very difficult to answer, but maybe we are in a halfway and we have something, but not everyone is happy about that. That is life. And as to some question, the cooperation between Bhutan and Japan, we also have the kind of platform for research activities in Asia, e-Asia. Through that platform, we coordinate cooperative activities multilateral, like between Japan, Bhutan, and other countries, so that we can share the experiences and expertise among us. And also, as to the question from our Japanese colleague, I couldn't catch the exact meaning, so I'd like to discuss with later. But one thing I'd like to mention, since this is part of answer to your raising point, I showed the project called COI, Center for Innovation. And during that project, within that project, one university has a center for innovation for water-related activities. I think it's the aqua innovation or something like that. They are good at the composite, using composite to purify waters and so on. So researchers at that center doing collaborative activities in one prefecture in Tanzania, which was where the water is contaminated with natural contamination. I forgot the name, but atomic explanation is AS. HISO in Japan, but AS.
Somebody.
Arsenia. Okay.
Arsenia, yes. So, since the world became smaller through ICTs, and so this university is not in Tokyo, but rather rural area of Japan, between this university and one prefecture at Tanzania can collaborate to that. I don't know what is the starting point of the collaboration, but this type of collaboration is really helpful, since this COI has researchers at the same time company which can produce the water purifying facility equipment. And if large company participate in this program, maybe they are not interested in the project in Tanzania, but it's a small company, so they are try to manufacture cheap or cost effective manner. So collaboration is now still going well. So that kind of we'd like to realize or materialize this kind of collaboration over the world.
Thank you. Nazar. So what happened now? We've been thinking, we're all thinking 10 years, more than 10 years time. If we find something that should be added, that should go beyond the SDG, what do we do with it? Can we come to UNESCO and say, hey, maybe we should do this? Or is there an SDG where we could also place other issues?
Well, if you're talking, of course, science, technology, and innovation, I think there is a room for innovative technologies to come under SDG 9. Even talking about data access and stuff like that, SDG 9 talks about data collection and analyzing and stuff like that. So SDG 9 can still incorporate within it, even the AI issue can come easily under that. But what I wanted to make sure that my last message went clear, I did not say that the SDGs were on course with the business as usual. No, We need to change course and save the situation. We need to set an action plan where, for example, you can have the worst case scenario and a best case scenario and work to achieve the minimum, at least for developing countries. But things need to change. That is important.
Thank you very much. Time is up. Well, not for the SDGs, just for the session. But allow me to say, one of my professors, Bill Clark from the Harvard Kennedy School, says that sustainable development is global well-being. So science for well-being, science for sustainable development. We look forward to working together, and please do stay in touch with each other, because it's only through partnership that we can achieve difference. Thank you.